The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is October 28th, 2013. That tells us that we're getting close to... I'm looking at my sound, so excuse me. Okay. That we're getting close to Halloween, today being, as I said, October 28th. And that festival will arrive on Thursday. Now, I just thought I'd mention it because I start seeing a lot of Halloween stuff around. And I just wanted to say that I don't really like Halloween as an adult. But naturally, as a kid, when I could go out trick-or-treating, I loved it. I mean, that's the part about it that I liked. And we always did that. We went out as much as we could, and we had a lot of fun. But, you know, what I don't like about it is that it's just another time when candy is focused on. And you people buy all this candy, hand all this candy out to kids. Not only what they get when they go trick-or-treating, and kids don't really go trick-or-treating like we used to. We were kind of hardcore about it, and we were out to get as much as possible. But, you know, I ended up with this bag full of junky stuff. And I tended to save the best part and eat the worst part. And then, you know, this big sack I had would sit in the pantry. My sister and I were kind of close in age, and her bag was on one side and mine was on the other. You know, it just was in there for weeks. And I did finally eat the better part. But, you know, you get down to this really old, stale stuff, and... I guess I finally threw it all out, but I never wanted to throw it away. I thought, oh, that's all good. But I was never that much of a candy eater, thank goodness. And I knew it wasn't good for me, and I didn't really feel good after eating it. I didn't like it that much, as much as my sister did. So it was just one of these things. And Easter's the same way, where they just, you know, all this sweet stuff is given to kids and adults too. So that's my opinion of it. I won't be having any kids coming to my house because where I live, it's kind of out of the way. And, the whole time I've been living here, which is quite a number of years now, is, I've never had a trick or treater. There's no kids in this neighborhood. And if there are, they don't come up here. So over to where I am. So I just ignore the whole thing. Well, so that's my words on Halloween. But one thing I remember that when we were back when I was a kid, we didn't need to be chaperoned. And now, you know, when these kids go around, their parents are right there with them. And it's really, it says a lot about our society. We could go out at night, run around, nothing ever happened and nobody ever worried about it either because this nothing was going to happen. At that time, that's the way it should still be. All right. I think I don't have hardly any listeners, but I think I have a, tonight listening live. I don't think this, topic might be getting old for people, but I'm going to see it through. And I think I've got a very good show actually, lined up here. And if you are interested in the revision of the Holocaust, if you're not, then I guess you wouldn't be too interested. But I'm going to start out tonight with talking about this, asking the question, should there be an organized revisionist response to the 2014 International Holocaust Remembrance Day, coming up this January 27th. Well, yes, I think there should be. And there's a number of confusions to clear up first, though, about, like, when is International Holocaust Remembrance Day? It turns out there are more than one. Actually, I brought up this subject with Germar Rudolph yesterday, I guess, and he was very nice about it, and sounds like he would get involved in it and help out with it. And I need to contact some more people, which I will do in the coming days and see what can be what can come up about this, what can be done about this. But the fact is, what interested me when I started looking it up, and I've talked about this and thought about this before, is that, of course, there's more than one Holocaust Remembrance Day. And as you look up different websites, they sort of overlap, and you can't tell why this one is in January, and the other one is in the springtime. But I had to do quite a bit of research and looking to finally get to the actual history of all of this and why it is the way it is. I mean, I knew generally why it was, but so first I will talk about I'll go to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And if you go there and to the, you know, Remembrance Days or Day of Remembrance or whatever, you will find that they say the United States Congress established the Days of Remembrance as the nation's annual commemoration of the Holocaust and created the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum as a permanent living memorial to the victims. They were created at the same time along with their funding, naturally. And see, this is what I want to point out here, that this obligation to remember the Holocaust as on an annual commemoration day every year went right along with the creation of the Holocaust Memorial Museum. And Congress put this under the auspices of this Holocaust Council that they named, which Elie Wiesel was the head of. And it was Jimmy Carter, who was president at the time, and who they lobbied and who went along with it. And then the council met for a while, and it was all Jews on this council. The thing you have to understand is this whole thing in the United States with the USHMM and so on, and these Days of Remembrance and so on, is all Jews, and it's basically only Jews that participate in it. And then, you know, and then it is members of Congress and politicians and so on who they bend their arms, you know, get to come at least to some of these particular activity. At least they have one in the congressional building. And they come, and or they might make statements or something. At the site, the point I want to make here is that since at the website that I just was talking about, it says since 1982, the museum has organized and led the National Days of Remembrance. And then they put in parentheses Yom HaShoah ceremony in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. So even though the museum was not dedicated and open for business until 1993, these Days of Remembrance started right away in the United States. And I thought, well, that was before what they're doing in Israel. But I finally got, let me see what I've got here. I just have a little bit more here. I guess I'll continue with this in the United States. So this year, in April, it's going to be April 27th to May 4th, 2014. And this particular one, I'm going to jump ahead here to Yad Vashem. Now, Yad Vashem Memorial Museum in Jerusalem is very similar to our U.S. Holocaust Museum. It's Israel's place where they take care of all the remembering of the Holocaust and all of the historical research, and, you know, they're funded by the government and so on, and try to, of course, get a lot of donations. But and then they keep it going there, and they call their day Yom HaShoah, which is basically remembering the Holocaust. You know, and it was inaugurated in 1953. It was anchored in a law signed by the Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, and the President of Israel, Yitzhak Ben-Zvi. And they on their website, they call it the Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah, in Hebrew. And they call it a national day of commemoration in Israel, on which the 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust are memorialized. It is a solemn day beginning at sunset on the 27th of the month of Nisan and ending the following evening, according to the traditional Jewish custom of how you make a day. Places of entertainment are closed and memorial ceremonies are held throughout the country. The central ceremonies are in the first evening and the following morning. They're held at Yad Vashem and are broadcast on television. And they're saying who all participates in it. And in the evening ceremony with the president of Israel and the prime minister and so on, the survivors, they have 6 torches representing the 6 million murdered Jews. They light the torches. The following morning, the ceremony begins again with the sounding of a siren for 2 minutes throughout the entire country. For the duration of the sounding, all work is halted. People stop walking in the streets. Cars pull off to the side of the road. Everybody stands at silent attention in reverence to the victims of the Holocaust. Now, I had thought this didn't start until 2002. Because something was done then, but it was started in 1953. And then when our United States Congress established the Days of Remembrance for Americans, for our nation, I always ask this question, you know, why our nation does this as a nation? See, it's so phony because, as I already said, it's only the Jews that are involved in it. And they don't even want non-Jews involved because, you know, they want to run it all themselves and do it how they want to do it. And the entire Holocaust Memorial Museum is run by Jews. I'm sure they have a few Gentiles here and there, but not in anything important. And they, of course, they have Negro guards. They have black Washington, D.C. people as guards, but the rest of it, it's all... They give themselves all the jobs there. But it is patterned after this one in Israel. And it's even called Yom HaShoah. And it's on the same date. So the one in Israel is the 27th day of Nisan. Well, that's the Hebrew or the, you know, the I guess you'd call it Hebrew calendar. And it is such that as it corresponds to our calendar, and the calendar in most of the rest of the world, at least in the European world, it's changeable. So for us, that date changes depending on when the 27th of Nisan falls for us. So it's sometime usually in April. It could even be in the end of February, the beginning of May, but it's usually in April. And as they said, this coming year, it's... I said what it was going to be April 27th to May 4th. Funny, it falls on the 27th, just like the January 27th one does. But it doesn't always fall on April 27th. But it's a week, just like in Israel, it's a week. But there's one particular day. I think it's the first day, unless it's the last day. I don't know. I guess it's the first day. That is the most special day. And the so continuing with the one here, the museum, see, runs it, and they've designated the theme "Confronting the Holocaust: American Responses" for 2014. And I guess that's about it. Okay, that's it for that. Now. Now, I'll just a little note here that in the Israeli one is run by Professor Yehuda Bauer right now, who's academic advisor to Yad Vashem. People who are familiar with Holocaust literature are familiar with him. And he's advisor, and they have a task force for international cooperation on Holocaust education, remembrance, and research delivered, the Remembrance and Beyond keynote address at the United Nations on January 27th, 2006. So now that brings us up to the United Nations and what occurred there in 2006. That was the first, commemoration of the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, or sometimes it's called Memorial Day, and they're getting these titles mixed up because they all want to use Remembrance Day. So it ends up seeming like there are two Remembrance Days, you know, in the year for the Holocaust, which basically there are, because more and more with this Yad Vashem one, and which it is also our American one, in spring, they want to get more and more people actually participating in that. And then we have the other one. Now, the International Holocaust Memorial Day, or the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, it's more often called, actually stems from the United Nations. This is the one in January, on January 27th. And it's more recent. Let's see, where's all my notes from this? Okay, I'll read this first. This is from 2006, the first one that they did. And they wrote for this, on January 27, 1945, the Red Army liberated the concentration and death camp of Auschwitz. This was not the end of the slaughter of World War II, which cost the lives of some 35 million people, most of them civilians. The war was to continue for over 3 months more. This is from the address given by Yehuda Bauer at this United Nations Special Memorial Day, January 27th in 2006. And this was part of his speech. He said, some 10 days prior to the liberation of Auschwitz, 58,000 inmates were marched away because the Nazis did not want them to fall alive into the hands of the liberators. Of course, that's not true. The reason they were marched away was because, according to the Geneva Convention, if you had prisoners and you were leaving a battle area, you know, and you were retreating from that area, you couldn't leave those prisoners behind. You had, you know, to face the oncoming forces, you had to take them with you. And the Germans were always doing things the way they were supposed to do them. And the ones they took with them, of course, were the ones who were capable of making that march. And it wasn't the kind of death march that they've made it out to be. It was less than 24 hours. They started at night after dark, and then they went until the next morning, and they stopped somewhere where they had some shelter, and they rested for a few hours. Then they started out again in the afternoon, and they got to their destination in the evening, where they also had, there was a camp there, and they spent a few days there, and then they got on a train and went to Buchenwald. So, and the ones who were not able to walk, you know, or to do that march, or the ones who were in the hospital at the time, and we're going to come up to that, 7,000. Were allowed to stay there under the supervision of a few doctors, and if you know, and the elderly too, and the children stayed behind. Anyway, this Yehuda Bauer continues in his speech, saying instead they had to go on what has become known as the death marches. Over half of them would die as a result. They left behind the ashes and bones of over 1 million human beings. Oh, yeah. More than 900,000 of them Jews, most of whom died by gassing, and some 7,000 sick and dying inmates, including, now these are the ones who were left in the hospital. They weren't necessarily dying, but they call them that. Sick and dying inmates, including Jewish and Roma children on whom the German doctors had performed murderous medical experiments. So you see what you can get away with at the United Nations, this kind of a speech, and nobody complains because they're all in on the game of pushing this kind of thinking. Well, I was looking at the United Nations Declaration. How this got started, why the United Nations took so long to do this. Well, there was a, where do I have that? There was a United Nations, maybe it's up higher. Anyway, there was a United Nations, what was that? Declaration of Human Rights. I think that's it. And it was in 1948. That's the one that Eleanor Roosevelt got involved in. And a bunch of those socialist left-wing people right after the war, you know, and they came up with this. They had formed the United Nations, and they came up with this Declaration of Human Rights. And I don't think it said anything in about the Holocaust, because, you know, as we all know, the Holocaust was not the big deal. We had the Nuremberg tribunals and so on, but this Holocaust was not the deal that it became later. So it took until 2005, actually, at the 60th session, which was also of the UN, which was also the 28th special session, in October 2005, for them to pass this declaration. And it is called, they wrote on this, you know, what it says on their, you know, it's a big paper, big charter. In their charter, it says, it's called, the General Assembly decides to designate 27 January as annual International Day of Commemoration to honor Holocaust victims. Okay? And then, you know, I found that on a PDF, and reading what it said, it was really kind of shocking, and it just reminded me, and I want to remind you of what the United Nations stands for. And of course, it was created right after World War II with the Allied victory. But they were forming it and talking about it before that, before the end of the war. And it is the creation of that. It is the creation of the Allied victors of the war and the world that they wanted to bring into being. Now that they had all the power and, you know, looked like the absolute good guys, and in the name of democracy and so on, they were going to form this what we now call the New World Order. And in this declaration, we find all of this here. And of course, as I said, this declaration wasn't written until 2005, and the first commemoration was not until 2006. The one that I'm talking about, for us to do something about a revisionist version of International Holocaust Memorial Day on January 27th, 2014. This is where it began. And the United Nations Declaration, I'm going to read it because I think it's so worthwhile to know what's in it. They start out, as they do in these kind of declarations, reaffirming the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948. That's the one I was talking about. Which proclaims that everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth therein, without distinction of any kind, such as race, religion, or other status, recalling Article 3 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which states that everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person, recalling also Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and Article 18 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which states that everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. Just think about that, freedom of thought. We do not have the right to freedom of thought in some places, and don't have the right to freedom of conscience, I don't think. Of course, religion is really not a problem. Bearing in mind that the founding principles of the Charter of the United Nations, quote, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, unquote, is testimony to the indelible link between the United Nations and the unique tragedy of the Second World War. Now, there they said the founding principle of the United Nations is to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. How well are they doing with that? Recalling the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Naturally, they have to get that in there. Which was adopted in order to avoid repetition of genocides such as those committed by the Nazi regime. So you see right away here now they're bringing in the word Nazi, and they are setting the United Nations is set up against anything Nazi, and Nazis are responsible for the genocide in World War II. They continue, recalling also the preamble of the United Declaration of Human Rights, which states that disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind. And then, taking note of the fact that the 60th session of the General Assembly is taking place during the 60th year of the defeat of Nazi regime. So there again, they're bringing up the Nazis as, they're this is the 60th year of that defeat at this time when they're making this new declaration. So that, again, it's like aimed against. And as they aim it against what they want to use the term Nazism, they're aiming it against nationalism, all nationalism. And everything in this declaration makes nationalism impossible. Oh, continuing. Recalling the 28th special session of the General Assembly, a unique event held in commemoration of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps. That was back when that was taking, that was back quite a number of years. Because this is the 60th and that was the 28th. Honoring the courage and dedication shown by the soldiers who liberated the concentration camps. You see, these were the heroes, the soldiers who liberated the camps. You know, these soldiers were some of the scummiest people ever who liberated those camps. And they are ignorant, too, and they murdered innocent German guards and others who were there who were only doing their job, you know, and doing their job as they should. They're trying to hand over the camps, and they just came in and murdered these people. But they're being honored here. That's not mentioned, you know. And continuing, reaffirming that the Holocaust, which resulted in the murder of one-third of the Jewish people, along with countless members of other minorities. So here the Jewish people, who do you think wrote this declaration, huh? Here the Jewish people are being singled out as being the victims, and they're saying that one-third of them were murdered. And then they just mention the others in a group as minorities. Will forever be a warning to all people of the dangers of hatred, bigotry, racism, and prejudice. Then, one, now this is what the declaration is doing. One, resolves that the United Nations will designate 27 January as the annual International Day of Commemoration in memory of the victims of the Holocaust. Two, urge member states to develop educational programs that will inculcate future generations with the lessons of the Holocaust in order to help prevent future acts of genocide. And in this context, commends the Task Force for International Cooperation on Holocaust Education, Remembrance, and Research. And then three, rejects any denial of the Holocaust as an historical event, either in full or part. Four, commends those states which have actively engaged in preserving those sites that served as Nazi death camps, concentration camps, forced labor camps, and prisons during the Holocaust. So here the United Nations is commending that they keep these places, you know, going, and they preserve them, and those who do it are commended, and so on, rather than letting it go so we can think about peace in the world. But number five, condemns without reserve all manifestations of religious intolerance, incitement, harassment, or violence against persons or communities based on ethnic origin or religious belief, wherever they occur. And then the last one, six, requests the Secretary General to establish a program of outreach on the subject of the Holocaust and the United Nations, as well as measures to mobilize civil society for Holocaust remembrance and blah, 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 blah. Goes on like that. And then that's it. So, you know, if anybody still thinks of the United Nations as a place that there is hopeful, or where that wants world peace, or that wants anything close to what we want, or that we should turn to the United Nations to accomplish our goals, I would say that is just absolutely foolish, because the United Nations was made by and is a speaks for the New World Order. And any kind of world peace it's looking for, it's going to stand up against, is just the kind of world peace where people are actually stripped of their national identity and just and made to be equal. Is the peace is one of where everybody's equal. We're going to have what is in store. What they want is a world of identityless people, and people with not only no racial identity, no national identity, no anything, and no particular, not even the color of people is going to become more similar, they hope. That's what the whole plan is, to make a world where everybody only considers themselves as a human being. You know, well, I'm just a human being, and that's the only identity you're going to have. So I thought that was pretty much of an eye-opener. And so this January 27th day of celebrating a Holocaust, remembering the Holocaust, is a United Nations thing. And that's why it's called International. It's the International Day. And it was ordered, as I said, by the New World Order, Jew World Order, beginning in 2005. This is just some facts about it, you know. I don't need to repeat that. All right. And some other, you know, I'm just Googling it. You know, as I said, I found lots of confusion about April 8th, I think it was in 2012 that the Holocaust Remembrance Day, the Yom HaShoah, was on April 8th. This coming year, it's going to be on April 27th, so it moves around. But you get these two different dates, and some places are really seem to be talking about one when they're actually talking about the other. And I think the confusion is kind of on purpose, because I think that they want to get this this Yom HaShoah Day and American United States Remembrance Day to become more international. But in any event, we have two of these days, and I bet it confuses a lot of people. So now, I think the actual title for January 27th is International Day of Commemoration for Victims of the Holocaust. But, you know, I think you can call it other things too, but it also commemorates, as you all know, I'm sure, when the Soviet troops liberated the Auschwitz-Birkenau camp, which they call a death camp, in Poland. That isn't even accurate, but that's the date that's given, January 27th, 1945, and. Okay, an article that I read about this year's event that's coming up ends with, I've talked about it before, you know, how the Israeli Knesset is sending a delegation led by this Yuli Edelstein, and they've got an American delegation going, and you know, and other things that are going to be at the Auschwitz Birkenau Memorial. And also, they also have, they also do this at the United Nations. They have a big ceremony at the United Nations. And they have them in, where I had that, somewhere, the different places. They even do it, they do it in Israel, they do it in U.S., they do it, you know, everybody joins into this. The U.K., and all, every country that, you know, is bullied into doing something about it. But, okay, this article ends with, according to Sam Nunberg, the director of North American Outreach of From the Depths, a Jewish organization, the international delegation will also include a senior bipartisan group of leaders from the U.S. Congress. They will be joined by a number of Holocaust survivors from North America, headed by Nobel laureate and survivor Elie Wiesel. His name should actually be pronounced Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel, but not with a big accent on the last syllable, which people tend to put on it. In addition to the Knesset hearing at Auschwitz-Birkenau, Yuli Edelstein, Rabbi Lau is that, he's in Israel, and he was that little boy, 4 years old, the youngest person at Buchenwald, that they celebrate, you know, show pictures of him and stuff. Now he's all grown up into an old rabbi. And Elie Wiesel will lead the delegation in a symbolic walk through the camp. Isn't that nice? A special memorial service will then be held to mark the 70th anniversary of the deportation of Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz-Birkenau. That would have been because it was in 1944, they say, before symbolically ending with the singing of the Hatikva and afternoon Mincha prayers. And how Jewish can you get, huh? And they are, of course, next year, in 2015, will be the 70th anniversary of the liberation, so-called, of Auschwitz-Birkenau. The, you know, from 45 to 15. So that will be a really big event. This year it's the 69th. So it's just normal. It's just being done in a normal way. And finally, they write, noting the importance and urgency of combating anti-Semitism, Edelstein warns, we must not wait until the trains start going to Auschwitz-Birkenau once again. Well, I've said before, and I'm saying again, that the big theme they're going to have is the need to combat anti-Semitism. And they're really ramping up to get all the countries do not have these laws and have resisted having these laws to bully and push them into passing laws outlawing anti-Semitism, which is one of the most ridiculous things that could ever happen. And yet there are a lot of states that kind of have them. And we know that when the Jews took over Russia and turned it into the Soviet Union, the Bolsheviks, they, first thing they did, and that was under Lenin, was to pass a law criminalizing anti-Semitism. And that's what they're trying to do all over the world today. So are we not in the same communist one world, you know, takeover that was going on then? Same communist idea that we're, you know, not national borders, but a big class conflict, big class division. Now, another little thing I found for, this is about the UK, and the UK has their Holocaust Memorial Day for 27 January on that same, you know, same one with the international United Nations one. And they have their own theme, or this, no, this is the theme. I think I found this theme other places. The theme is journeys for the 2014, and they said in their little promotion stuff, they say, we can learn how journeys themselves became part of genocide and how the journeys undertaken were often experiences of persecution and terror for so many people who suffered in the Holocaust under Nazi persecution. And in the subsequent genocides, we can also learn about the life stories of journeys that brought survivors to the UK, and how in many instances journeys of return have been part of the experience of rebuilding. You see how they can pick out these themes like this word journeys, and they can use it in ways that fit their agenda, and they can talk about journeys in all kinds of ways and then create all kinds of stories and, you know, human interest stories and so on. They don't even have to be about Holocaust, just people going on journeys and tie it into the Holocaust and just try to make it, they're trying to make it meaningful to people. They're trying to make people connect it to their life today, you know, because they don't want people to just see this is all in the past. What do we want to keep hearing about this for? They're always working to try to connect it to people's lives today. And this in the United Kingdom, it's sponsored by something called where is that? I don't know. They have the Holocaust Trust or something in the United Kingdom. And, you know, they're building their own museum now. That came out a little while ago. And I don't have that information right here, but the announcement was made. And they're going to have a big Holocaust museum in probably in London. I don't know where they're going to put it, but they didn't say. I don't think it's said yet. But so that they're not, they'll have one like the United States has. In Washington, D.C., and then they'll tie in. This is the Holocaust Trust. That is a big organization there, and they'll tie that in with their Memorial Days business. They say, all right. In 1999, Andrew Dismore, MP, asked Prime Minister Tony Blair about the creation of a Memorial Day for the Holocaust. In reply, Tony Blair also referred to the ethnic cleansing that was being witnessed in the Kosovo War. And he said, Tony Blair said, "I am determined to ensure that the horrendous crimes against humanity, the Holocaust, are never forgotten." The Labour Party. Well, that's a little background. So why I'm thinking it would be a good idea for us to do something like a educational program of our own for International Holocaust Remembrance Day, January 27, 2014. And what I have in mind is since having an actual conference that people would travel to is such a huge undertaking, and I don't know anybody who'd want to do it, and not too many people who would be willing to go and be so expensive and so on, that we could do it as a online. And then after discussing that some more, it was like, well, just the best thing is just to put up a website, and that will hold all the information and tell the story that we want to tell. And then promote it a lot ahead of time and put it up maybe the day before on Sunday the 26th and hope that people will go there and see it and leave it up as long as it will stay up, as long as somebody, it's not torn down, you know, taken down. But some of my thinking here is that the current narrative that we have today actually incites intolerance and harassment against innocent persons as much as it says it, you know, says it condemns it. But it also incites it against people who are considered like people like us, you know. If you don't go along with it, if you have a different idea about it, well, that's not allowed. So that's very intolerant. And to question how the currently accepted historical account of the Holocaust has got it wrong This will be presented as clearly as possible that the current historical account is wrong. And, you know, as the UN said, they didn't pass a law or anything, but they're condemning anyone who would deny the historical reality of the Holocaust. And we would be saying, you know, on here that, that you have to question the historical reality of it and explain why, and also why it is necessary to allow ongoing research into this historical event. That all historical event, we know all these arguments, but it would be put hopefully in a way that would be attractive and is easy to read, at least the front page, and help, you know, get people to think about it. And why the current Orthodox Holocaust narrative is not and should not be accepted as the last word on what actually took place. That's all probably about the same. And finally, why anti-Semitism is not a problem for the world, but only a problem for Jews. I think it's necessary to address that push to criminalize anti-Semitism and explain why, you know, why it's such a terrible idea. And also, that it really is not a problem for the, well, I just said that. And how the Jews can get rid of it easily by changing their behaviors and leaving countries that don't want them there. And maybe more Jews going to Israel. Well, those, of course, my ideas that that would not be what everybody would think should be done. And I hope to have a kind of a committee, of, good revisionists who will, work on this. And put this material together. So let's see a little bit, a couple more things I've got here, but I don't know if I should read them. This is a story in The Guardian. Oh, here's what I was looking for, thinking about before. It says that on the Friday, the 27th of January, ceremonies will take place at the headquarters of the United Nations in New York and in Israel and at Auschwitz in Poland. So, and, that's the big places. New York, Israel, and Auschwitz in Poland. Of all places, the day is commemorated worldwide. I don't need to tell you that. It is associated with the liberation of Auschwitz, which is very good because, the whole liberation of Auschwitz can be, you know, is questionable of how it actually came about and how the Soviets, closed down that camp right away and were operating in there and doing whatever they wanted to do. And we know a lot of what they were doing. They were tearing things down, building other things, changing things, and so on. They were, as soon as they liberated any area, their political commissars and the security propaganda experts and so on moved in. They were always associated with the Red Army troops, and they moved in and started figuring out how to make good propaganda out of what they had there. That's what they were doing there. So that all that could be talked about. And I just have this little item that in Britain, this date, the 27th of January, has been marked since 2001. So they were in there. They were ahead of the United Nations. And they had, and this was, again, here it is. The survey was carried out for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. That's some organization they have in Britain. And it shows that more than half the respondents felt social media had a role to play in fighting hatred and discrimination and so on. Okay, so this is what the 27th of January is, and it's always the same. It's always the 27th of January. It's not like the one in the spring that changes and shifts around and is basically started in as Israel's special day. Now, I'm going to go on. I've got about nine minutes or less before the break, but that's good. So I'm going to move on to back to the Action Reinhardt Camp's book by Matonio Graf and Cues. It's called The Extermination Camps of Action Reinhardt that I've been talking about for, this is part five already, and I'm going to be dealing with chapter eight tonight. But first, I want to talk about, maybe I can do this in this time before the break starts, the name Action Reinhardt, which I had said on a previous program that that the exterminationists and Holocaust historians have changed it to Reinhard without the T so that they can say it's about Reinhard Heydrich, and that the revisionists call it Reinhardt with a T on the end, DT. And I thought they were saying that it was not Reinhard Heydrich for that reason, but I found out today, and with the help of Germar Rudolph, that that's not what they're saying. And he directed me to the book Sobibor that they wrote and came out with a couple of years ago. In fact, I talked about this book. In fact, Jürgen Graf wrote a summary for me to give to read on the air. And I did a program on it, actually two, but only half an hour each time, or 1 hour, half the show each time. But I had the book. I forget about all these books I have, but I got the book out, and he told me what the pages were, and I'll tell you, it is, let me get this. It is page 230 something to, why am I not seeing that here? To 250. Well, let me open it up. Page 236 to 250 in the Sobibor book, if you have it. But they have this section on the name Action Reinhardt and where it comes from and so on. And you know, it's not very clear. And it's not a sure thing at all as far as I'm concerned. I first looked in Wikipedia, and Wikipedia writes about this on their Action Reinhardt page, which I think is good of them. It's somebody put it in there, and they left it there. It's hypothesized that the operation was named after Reinhard Heydrich, the coordinator of the Final Solution. This has been disputed by some researchers who argue that, and you know, when you look on the internet and you write it with a T, you know, Action Reinhardt, Operation Reinhardt, or even Reinhardt Heydrich with a T, they don't show anything with a T. They just show it without the T. And everywhere it's spelled without the T for both the operation, the action, and for the man himself. But no, Germar Rudolph told me that they found his birth certificate and found that his last name, his name did have a T, Reinhardt. But yet it's kind of odd because he never used that T. And I saw an image of a stamp that the National Socialist regime issued in 1943 with his picture on it, with, I guess, you know, after he was assassinated, and it's spelled with a D without the T. So that's the way he always spelled it. So I find this all really confusing. But I'll go on here with what Wiki says. This has been disputed by some researchers who argue that since the more mainstream designation of the operation was Action Reinhardt, with a T, it could not have been named after Reinhard Heydrich. They argue that it was named after German State Secretary of Finance Fritz Reinhardt. In November 1946, Rudolf Huss, the former commandant of Auschwitz, asserted in a report while in Polish custody in Krakow that Operation Reinhardt was actually the code name, that's Reinhardt with a T, actually the code name for the collection, sorting, and utilization of all articles acquired from the transports of Jews sent to the extermination camps. Well, that would indicate more that it would be named after that German Secretary of Finance. But I'm starting to see something here that I did not see before, and that is if it's wise for us to want to have it named after the Secretary of Finance and have it be mostly a collection of belongings, wealth, and, you know, clothing, but also jewelry and all the things that the Jews owned, just taking their property. Now, so to begin, in their book, Sobibor, MGK, I'm going to call them that, Metonier Graf Q's, have a section on, and here's where I have pages, 236 to 250. They say that Reinhard Heydrich's name was spelled Reinhardt with a T. They accept the idea that Operation Reinhardt was the deportation of the Jews to the East plan, to the East, the plan for that, that's, and that was outlined at the Von Sieg by Heydrich. Well, I'll just say in here, because I've already got my 60-second prompt, that, okay, that there's, I am uncertain that there is ever an official something called Operation Reinhardt, or that it was a code for some, for this deportation of the Jews, that it was ever used as the code. This is basically the idea that it wasn't known, but it was a code word among the Germans for the deportation of the Jews and also the acquisition of their belongings since they were leaving. And that was the idea. But there's no real evidence that the Germans had said, well, this is Operation Reinhardt and, you know, or Action Reinhardt, and this is, you know, something that we're doing. It was never officially.
In 5 minutes.
Thank you.
right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm going to move. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour, and it is October 28th already. And I'm going to move on with this to give a little bit of information from the book Sobibor, written by Matonio Graf and Cuse, and it came out in 2010. And in this section about the spelling of Reinhardt and the action Reinhardt and where it came from and so on. In fact, this section is called Origins and Significance of Action Reinhardt, but it doesn't give as much clarification as one would want, because there is none that exists, is what it is. And so this some of the evidence for Reinhardt as a code name for this action is comes from Witte and Tyus, who wrote the code name Reinhardt with a T for the mass murder first. They are Holocaust historians, so they call it the mass murder. First appeared immediately after Heydrich's death in June 1942, but say MGK, this was only in a letter from a Waffen SS Standort Verwaltung, whatever that rank is, of Lublin to Police Fuhrer Reinhardt Lublin, requesting, quote, 50 empty suitcases stemming from the known action, unquote. So this is just among themselves, a certain officer, SS officer in Lublin, wrote to or sent a message to or something, and to what he called Police Fuhrer Reinhardt, or maybe it was about that. I don't know if Reinhardt Heydrich was there or not, requesting some stuff from this action, from this what he called the known action. That's not that's not anything official. That's just a little thing. So other evidence, they say that there's an undated report from Globochnik. He was supposedly one of the heads of the mass murder of the Jews in these camps and so on in the East. But it's an undated report. It's labeled NO-657. And, it doesn't sound too important, but it says the whole of Action Reinhardt can be split up into four areas. This is what Globochnik wrote. A, the deportation itself. B, the use of the manpower. C, the use of objects. D, the securing of hidden values and real estate. Or maybe they meant valuables. But anyway, hidden, things of value. So you have the deportation. There's nothing about extermination here. You have the deportation, you have the labor from the people, from the Jews who are in custody, in detention. You have their labor. You have the use of objects. I don't know what that means. And then the securing of their valuables. And if they're going to be leaving for good, then they're going to leave a lot behind, or they don't need to take it all with them. So then they were collecting all that stuff. And then MGK say, in the Sobibor book, all surviving documents about Action Reinhardt refer exclusively to the economic aspect. Even at Auschwitz, it's connected. This is my wording here in this sentence. Even at Auschwitz, it's connected to Canada One. And, that's that place where all the goods at Auschwitz, the clothes, jewelry, etc., were sorted. And the things were shipped in from other places. And it's supposed to have been a place with lots of valuable goods, but and just some regular goods too. That was just the name it was given, Canada. That's not the official name. That was just something that the people in the camp called it. But the authors still say that Heydrich was therefore, in actual fact, the chief planner of the final solution in Europe, but This term designated the evacuation of the Jews from Europe, or i.e. from the general government. You know, it didn't designate murder. They also say the choice of Heydrich's first name, Reinhardt, in this context, thus indicates the continuity of the task entrusted to him by Göring in 1939 and extended to 1941, that is to resolve the Jewish question, quote, the Jewish question by means of emigration or evacuation, unquote. It follows that Action Reinhardt, in its main aspect, resettlement, or in German, Aussiedlung, I guess, was nothing but the implementation of this task of, you know, evacuating all these people, all these Jews. And the executor, Globochnik, acted in his capacity of commissioner for the installation of SS and police agencies in the new eastern region. So that's their judgment on that. And so what I get from that is they are accepting that Action Reinhardt was named after Reinhard Heydrich. And I have come to see that they like it this way because they accept another thing they accept is the Wannsee Conference and the Wannsee Protocol, which I have done programs on that too and have taken a different direction on that and have questioned that because there's a lot of questions about it being a forgery. I don't know why people... Okay, well, I won't. But they accept it, and I think it's because this all fits together for them. And their intention is to show, because they believe it. I mean, they think this is what the facts are, that there was this big plan to evacuate the Jews in out of Europe and out of all their you know, the larger German controlled state, and create a German, bring German people into the East and create a larger Germany, so to speak, with homogeneous people. And so that's what the Wannsee Protocol said too. The Wannsee Protocol never talked about any extermination plan, only talked about taking people out, you know, removing the Jews and then using them for labor until the war was over and they didn't need them anymore, then they would find a place for them to go. That always was there. They were going to find a final place for Jews to go where they would be where they would not be in our countries. And so this is what this fits in for them, because if it was in the Wannsee Protocol and then this is what they're actually doing, they were using the name Reinhardt for it, then that's just fine. And, you know, it could have been, because I don't think this was an official, like, Operation Barbarossa or something where they gave, you know, I think it was just people within the government who were associated with it who started calling it Action Reinhardt because out of affection or something, or respect or something for Reinhard Heydrich. That's why they use the first name, if this is true. No, I don't find that there's any clarity about this at all, because it just doesn't seem to exist. And if it doesn't exist, that probably means that it was just a kind of a code name among the people involved in it. It wasn't a big code name. I'm going to stop on that, best I can do on that. So I've changed my... You know, I was so certain about it before, but I really, as so often happens, I take a position. But now that I know more about it, I'm not sure. You know, it can be, but I'm not sure either way. I'm not convinced either way. But so, chapter 8 in the book, the quote extermination camps unquote of Action Reinhardt quote unquote. both those things are in quotes. And first we have Carlo Mantogno's response on page 804 to 964. That's 160 pages. Well, I looked through that, and, well, it's just so much. And it was a lot of variety in there, and a lot of answering various points made by Jason Myers. He's the least known one of the five bloggers, and he's the one that undertook this, to criticize Mantogno and Q's over what they wrote about the camps, the Reinhardt camps, so-called. So that's what this was about. Carlo Mantogno was pretty much answering everything he came up with, and there's a whole range of stuff. And so I just couldn't make too much out of it, so I went on. I thought I wanted to really cover Thomas Q's response, which is page 964 to 1065, 101 pages. And he's got it divided into sections, which makes it a little easier. And the first one is on skin discoloration of carbon monoxide poisoning, which is where Fritz Berg has talked about this a lot, where when carbon monoxide was what was supposed to have been used, according to these witnesses, eyewitnesses, in these three camps, Sobibor, Belzec, and Treblinka. And that turns the bodies after they're dead, into actually a cherry red color. But the witnesses never mentioned that red color. They said, oh, after they went in to pull them out of the gas chambers, you know, after they were all dead, they were blue or they were pale or they were, you know, gray or something, but they never ever said red. He talks about that. And then the next section is Jason Myers' critique of Sobibor archaeological evidence. And Q's is pointing out innumerable instances of incorrect information from Myers. Partial quotes, that's one of their big things where you quote from somewhere, but you leave out the part that actually disproves what you're trying to prove. And that he caught him on that a lot of times. And, you know, that's actually lying, but then other lies and trickery and all that sort of thing. So I thought, well, we've already gone over a lot of that. So the next part, though, I really liked, and it's called New Book on Archaeological Surveys at Sobibor, page 995. And I'm going to read from that, but there's this book by these two men, Marek Bem, B-E-M, is the director of the Sobibor Park and Museum. And he and a Polish archaeologist named Mazurek, I'm not going to even try to pronounce his first name, in 2012, just last year, they published a book. So this is one of the newest books. And the title is Sobibor, Archaeological Research Conducted on the Site of the Former German Extermination Center in Sobibor, 2000 to 2011. So that covers all this last 11 years of all these various groups they've had going there and doing investigations, archaeological investigations, so-called. And so I am going to read to page 999, and so I got to go over there now. And I'm here, all right. And so I've got it all set up. It reads, this is chapter 8.2.3. In 2002, well, I just read that first part. This book, their book, which together with Jules Schelvis' study, and Jules Schelvis' study, he's a Holocaust historian too, an exterminationist, but Mantogno has written about him a lot and said that he is he is one of the more objective of the of these historians, and he has he really looks at the evidence more and he dismisses a lot of things because they're ridiculous that the others don't. So he has a certain amount of regard for Jules Schelvis. Schelvis. And now Q's is saying, is writing this. This is by Q's. So together, Jules Shelvis' study constitutes the most important exterminationist work on the camp. It deals with the final blow, he says. This book by these two exterminationists deals the final blow to our opponents' vain hope that the hard facts are on their side. Below, I will comment extensively on the material presented by Bem and Mazurek. So he starts out, death toll and killing procedure according to Marek Bem. Amazingly, already in the introduction to the book, Marek Bem manages to make a fool of himself by commenting on the death toll. And this is what this so-called expert, well, he turns out he's not an expert. He's the director of Sobibor, but this is what he writes. In my view, the number of people murdered in this complex, taking into account all the calculations made so far, was at least 300,000. This figure is, however, dependent upon the still unresolved question of the poorly documented railway deportations to Sobibor from places like Lublin, Warsaw, Travniki, Sampol, Tuchow, Smolensk, Mohilu, Borbusk, and Dubienka and Lvov. Resolving this problem could perhaps confirm that, indeed, at least 300,000 people were exterminated in Sobibor. Indeed, it cannot be excluded that the number could actually have been bigger. So I think you could have heard in there that he's saying that there were 300,000, but then he says that it's still unresolved, and you have poorly documented railway reports, I guess, from all these different places, not just one or two, but all these places. And yet he's saying, well, it could turn out to be that. So Q's writes, thus Bem's estimate of the camp's death toll is nearly twice that of Shelvis's 169,000. Since the Hoefele document shows that 101,370 Jews were sent to Sobibor until the end of 1942, Bem must believe that roughly twice that number arrived at the camp during the period from January to October 1943, despite the fact that all sources agree that the number of deportees during the second calendar year of operation was much lower than during the first, with a considerable lull from the arrival of the last Dutch convoy in late June 1943 to the first transport from the east in mid-September. Without giving a source, Bem is moreover the first to assert that convoys arrived in Sobibor from Warsaw, Smolensk in Russia, Mogilev in eastern Belarus, and Bobruisk also in eastern Belarus. So he's the first one that's ever said that convoys from those places came to Sobibor. Bem also writes that the decision to build the camp was most probably taken at the end of summer 1941, a date which does not sit well with the whole supposed Führerbefehl chronology as discussed in Chapter 2. Well, Matonio was telling us that this Christian Gerlach, yes, especially a Holocaust historian, so-called, was insisting that the Führerbefehl, that there was a Führerbefehl first, and that it was, it had to be between, it had to have come in, he finally decided that it came in December after the Pearl Harbor attack, after December 7th. It was sometime between then and towards the end of December. But he is saying that this decision to build the camp came in summer of 1941, which doesn't fit in with that kind of reasoning as far as exterminationists go. So Q says, next we should note for later reference how Bem describes the extermination procedure. And he's added his own emphasis. I'll tell you where he puts his emphasis. This is Bem. The old, the disabled, and the ill were loaded onto the wagons of the camp narrow gauge railway and were told that they were going to the lazarette or field hospital. Instead, they were shot dead in Camp 3. The rest of the newcomers were sent to Camp 2. From there, naked. Now, he underlines from there naked, which I think he doesn't believe that, and already divided into groups. They were herded to the gas chambers. In doing this, the women went first through a barrack, he underlines first through a barrack, where some prisoners, the so-called barbers, sheared their hair, in parentheses, which was considered to be of economic value. The gas chambers were furnished in such a way as to look like typical bathhouses. He underlines look like typical bathhouses. At first, these could accommodate 200 people at a time, underlines 200 people at a time. After the restructuring of the gas chambers, their capacity doubled. The victims were killed by means of exhaust fumes pumped into the chambers from a special annex with a petrol engine inside. Excuse me. The gassing procedure lasted a dozen or so minutes. When the gassing was over, the corpses were removed from the chambers and searched for hidden valuables. Excuse me. Oh, he also underlined a special annex with a petrol engine inside. Next, the bodies were trundled to and then placed into the mass graves in Camp 3. In the autumn of 1942, the corpses of the victims began to be incinerated on special grills made from rail tracks in open-air crematoria. The layers of bodies were interlaced with wooden logs, and then the bodies were poured over with the flammable substance and set on fire. The ashes were then thrown into pits dug in Camp 3. End of that. Now, Hughes writes, below we will find out how much or rather how little of this description is in fact supported by the archaeological evidence. As for the claim that the hair of the female victims was considered to be of economic value, I have already remarked how ridiculous it is to believe that the SS would have created a bottleneck in the extermination procedure just to get hold of about 100 kilograms of hair per transport, and that the procedure is much more consistent with a context of prophylactic hygiene. That is, what is being described is even more fits better with the idea that these people were being, taken to showers, they were being deloused, they were getting their hair cut for health reasons, for, you know, disease reasons. They were given, you know, clean clothing and so on. All of this goes with hygiene, not with extermination. Hughes says, in describing the present-day Sobibor Memorial, Bem makes the following statement on the location of the alleged gas chamber building, which I will address later. He writes, Bem writes, in all likelihood, the obelisk symbolizing the gas chamber and the monument of a woman prisoner with a child in her arms, so they have their, they've already built all this stuff there, you know, right away, before they knew, had found anything or dug up anything. They have an obelisk symbolizing the gas chamber, and then they have a monument of a woman with a child in her arms. These were built at the same time as the mound stand on the site of the gas chamber. The two monuments stand on the site of the gas chamber. This is what the planners and authors of these monuments aimed at when they undertook the task of building them. They wanted to have them built on the alleged site of the gas chamber. Many of the latest historical analyses imply that, indeed, this might be the place. Many of the latest historical analyses imply that, indeed, this might be the place where the gas chambers used to be. Yeah, they might have built this there, or they might not have. It might not be there. Hughes writes, the obelisk in question is located in the western half of the above-mentioned tarmac square, around which objects A to D were found. As noted in the previous section, the Polish witness Jan Piwanski pinpointed the location of the gas chambers at this place, and more exactly at the site of object A. A heading, Liquidation of the Camp and Early Investigations. Hughes writes, the first chapter of the book is devoted to a short history of the camps. This is Bem's book, Bem and Masaryk's book. A short history of the camp's liquidation, the most vital parts of which I have already cited in the previous section. At the chapter's beginning, we learn that on 19 October 1943, 5 days after the prisoner revolt, you know, there was supposedly a prisoner revolt at Sobibor. That's why they took it down. A meeting was held where, among others, SIPO and SD Commander Walter Bierkamp, Krakow Order Police Commander Hans Dietrich Grunewald, and head of the Armaments Inspectorate Maximilian Schindler, all Germans, SS people or police people, met to discuss the state of met to discuss the state of security in the general government, the danger posed by the Jewish camps in the region, and the strengthening of security police forces. Jewish camps in the region, they're not talking about the German camps, the National Socialist camp. They're talking about partisans who were camping in the area, who were hiding in the area in these camps and so on, and how dangerous they were. It was resolved, or so we are told, as no reference is given, quote, to take the final decision about how many Jews should be recognized as indispensable and useful as a labor force, and how many should be immediately removed from the general government region. As they say, that he says that, but doesn't give any reference for it. Himmler was then informed by Hans Frank about the conclusions of the meeting. Bem and Mazurek maintain, the unprecedented escape of the prisoners from the extermination center in Sobibor, which meant the necessity to liquidate the camp, gave Himmler the pretext to commence the final stage of the extermination of Jews in the general government lands. Q says, this, of course, ignores the prisoner and mass escape from the Treblinka extermination camp 2.5 months earlier on 2nd August 1943. Although this revolt did not lead to the immediate liquidation of the Treblinka camp, one might think that it would have caused the German leaders to react at a much earlier stage. Anyway, just, you know, this is, look what I did. I moved myself. I got hit that thing in the middle again. Oh, where did I start this? Now I have to find it again. Darn it. I'm on, page 995. Oh, I have to go down. Good thing I have all these page numbers here. Okay, one more. Sorry about this. I don't have time to waste either. So, you know, they say that because the... All right, well, I won't give my own explanation here. I'll just go on. In the second chapter, Mazurek and Bem chronicle the first post-war inquiries and investigations carried out at the campsite, primarily by the Historical Commission of Central Jewish Committee in Poland and the Central Commission for Investigation of German Crimes in Poland. Now, these are, you know, two basically communist Polish Soviet type commissions, and you know what they were doing. You can't believe what they're saying, but they conducted the official investigation into the Sobibor camp, as well as the topography of the camp. The chronicle begins. This means Ben, the Mazurek and Bem book. They're chronicling it. They begin on the 28th of September 1945. The Central Commission for Investigation of German Crimes in Poland informed the prosecutor of the regional court in Lublin that the commission had been notified that in via Dawa province, next to the Sobibor railway station, the Germans had founded a death camp where during 1942 and to 1944, numerous transports were sent for extermination, not only from Poland, but also from France, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Italy. This is what these commissions had come up with. Considering that Sobibor was liquidated in late 1943 and that no convoys from Hungary or Italy ever reached it, it is clear how well informed these investigators were as late as September 1945, meaning that they didn't care whether they had it right or not. They're very sloppy. You know, what they did was so sloppy because nobody was going to question them. You know, they were going to take this stuff to the trials in Nuremberg, and they were in control where they were, so nobody was going to say a word about what their findings were. The commission initially knew of four witnesses, Zelda Metz, Solomon Pochelnik, Salomea Hanel, and Hertz Kukierman. In October-November 1945, a site inspection was carried out. A situational plan drawn up and photographs were taken. At least nine witnesses were heard, among which at least two former camp prisoners, but who were unnamed by Bem and Mazurek, were heard. Samples of ashes and bones from the camp area were also sent to Krakow's Institute of Court Expertise to determine whether they derived from incinerated human corpses. Results of this survey were revealed to the public only in 1947 in a report by the commission, which we have discussed in our Sobibor study. And now there's a diagram here, and there's quite a few diagrams coming up, and this one shows was drawn by a fellow named Skwierowski in 1945. These are people who said they were there for one reason or another, and they made diagrams of how they remembered it to be. And I'm not going to spend time describing all this. This next section, witness maps of the camp. In the third chapter, Bem and Mazurek focus on plans, sketches, and drawings describing the area of the camp. They begin by discussing witness statements that had already been made during the war by a former Hungarian guard who had deserted. Well, this was Poplowski. I've got these notes on my other page here. I say, when I get to this page, discuss the diagrams. We have Skwierowski in 1945. We have Poplowski, who was turned out to be a partisan, and he said he escaped from Sobibor, and he went and met up with the partisans, and he told them all about it and gave them his story. And this was in 1943. I'm sorry. And then Kurt Thomas, or Kurt Tycho, also Tycho or Ticho, was a Czech Jewish eyewitness, and I don't have a date for him around. And there was a former other. Reports from former camp prisoners, unnamed, in 1946. And on the following pages, Bem and Mazurek present a number of later maps of the camp drawn by Yitzhak Arad, Tomas Blatt, Jules Shelvis, Alex Cohen, Martin Gilbert, Eugene Kogan, and Michael Tregenza, most of them already published elsewhere. Tregenza's map is typical of this exterminationist fantasist, depicting the area of Camp 3 as almost completely filled up with huge mass graves. So basically these maps, the diagrams these people have drawn, are not worth anything. Then I say next follows a section of sketches and maps drawn by former prisoners, Moshe Bashir, or Bakir, Chaim Engel, Kurt Thomas again, Stanislaw Smajner, and Alexander Pecherski. Only the rough sketch made by Pecherski features any details worth commenting. Q says he will return to this later. He says he will also discuss the sketches drawn by the former SS camp staff members Kurt Bolander and Franz Hudel later in this chapter and in chapter 10. Okay, so then I am going to begin again at 1006, page 1006. skip all this diagram stuff, which is too difficult to get across. And this is good. Begin reading. All right. Archaeological Research at Sobibor, 2000-2011. Oh, what did I do? I did it again. Oh no. I've got to go back down to 1006. Oh, I'm at 1004. Okay. Stop. Hit this thing in the middle. In the concluding, and no doubt, most important chapter of the book, Mazurek describes in chronological order and considerable detail the archaeological research carried out at the former Sobibor camp site between 2000 and 2012. Below, I will summarize and comment briefly on this survey chronicle, after which I will go on to analyze the information provided with regard to the three most vital issues raised by it. So there was Kola's survey in 2000-2001. This has been written about and talked about. I'm going to pass this by. I've got in my notes here, go to chapter 8249 on page 1030. So I'm going to do that. I wonder if there's anything here that I'm still going to read. And then we have the survey of 2004. They talk about that. And that was carried out by a museum, a Polish museum, under the leadership of Marek Bem, one of these authors, and in cooperation with United States TV Corporation, a German geophysical company, and a Polish archaeological company. And they set out to find, the stuff. I'm not going to go through all that, but they set out to find what they could. And they didn't come up with anything. So then we have, the next one is, I'm scrolling down here. The survey of 2007. And that was archaeologists from Ben-Gurion University in Israel, including Yoram Haimi and Isaac Gilead. And they joined forces with the former team at that Polish museum. And they did a lot of excavation work. They did geophysical research. Anyway, they find a few objects. They find some things. What's mostly been found there, if I can find a good description of it, there's several of them, is like, here's one. In the same layer were found pieces of spectacles, dentures, cigarette cases, machine gun cartridge cases, bullets, numerous shards of glass bottles and perfume containers, some with inscriptions in Dutch, some scissors and knives, as well as fence elements, that is, pieces of barbed wire, nails, and iron wire staples. Also, they found building remains of concrete and brick pieces, all of small size. Curtain fence were also discovered. And beneath the display, they came across two sheds of parallel ditches, both light gray sand. And they go on about all that. And this is the kind of thing that could very, it's always the same stuff. Again, they looked again, they find pieces of spectacle frames, fragments of and whole glass lenses, glass cigar cases, also barber's tools like iron scissors, eau de cologne bottles, perfume containers, and a piece of a shaving brush. So this very well fits with people who, you know, lots of people who have passed through there, who are brought in there, who are undressed, who go into the showers, who get their hair cut, who get their deloused and get clothes and so on, and a lot of this stuff they just leave behind. Maybe they realize by then that where they're going, you know, they don't need their cologne bottles. And they don't need, you know, some of this stuff. Or they just forget it, or it breaks and they, you know, it's already broken or something. You know, just stuff that's there that that they don't want to carry around anymore. Some of it, like this cologne, I can imagine. They wouldn't need that. So, you know, it's humanity. It can be sad if you want to think about it that way, if, you know, depending on how you look at it. But it doesn't show what would happen in an extermination camp. So then we go on to the next, couldn't be too far down, the survey of 2009. And this one was, again, you know, they're looking for these buildings that they say are there. They're looking for these mass graves and so on. And I don't see who even did it, but they talk about it. Then there was a survey, I guess that wasn't such a big one. Then there was a survey of 2010, and it was a continuation of excavations carried out in 2009. And they found post holes of the fences, and, you know, they find some areas filled with black sand and locksmith's waste, whatever that is. And what else did they find? Here they found a silver pendant with inscriptions in Polish of Hannah, and in Hebrew, God in Hebrew, and an unspecified number of pieces of dental work. Well, that's not, this is not the one I was thinking it was. They make a lot out of these things. See if I get to that. Then there was a survey of 2011. See how many times they've gone there, digging around, looking for stuff, using all their GPS and so on, and they don't find anything. This one might be where they list everything they're using. Survey of 2011. They say where they went, you know, what part of the area they were checking into. You can go and read all this. I'm not going to try to read it all. So far, I don't find this list, I recall. But let's see where I get to. Where am I now? I'm on page 1021. It says I want to go to page 1030, the futile search for the gas chambers. Yeah. So let me see here. Well, I'll leave that behind. I'll go on to page 1030. Here's 1024, Bem and Masaryk's interpretation of Object E. Well, I'm not going to do that. All right, here we are. 8249, with dots in between. The futile search for the gas chambers. As seen above and in our book Sobibor, the archaeologists' search for the alleged gas chamber building in this camp has led them to one retreat after another. Following Kola's initial very half-hearted hypothesis that Object E could have contained the fabled chambers of death, a suggestion which Bem, in obvious desperation, still clung on to as late as 2009. The subsequent archaeological teams have exhausted the areas to the west and the east of the above-mentioned object, the Object E, as well as the area around and between the identified grave pits. After subjecting the whole of the former Camp 3 site to probe drillings, excavations, geophysical surveys, and more probe drillings, the pitiful seekers of the gas chamber, Grail, arrived exhausted at one final possible location for the gas chambers in 2012 AD. And a quote from, how long is this quote? Okay. A quote from the Bem's book, However, the list of yet unanswered questions is still long, and their explanations can only be found through further excavation. Above all, it is necessary to fully understand the area of Camp 3. There, apart from locating other possible mass graves, it is necessary to pinpoint and identify the gas chamber area. Taking into account that the Himmelfahrtstrasse, that's the Himmel, going to Heaven Street, you know, go to Heaven Street, where they supposedly walked from the undressing room to the naked to the gas chamber, extends in a northerly direction, it can be assumed that these should be located either beneath the asphalt paved lot where the monuments are located, or is east of it. So they, you know, they've built all this stuff there. Now they have to dig under it, I guess. Hughes writes, more precisely, the spot is right next to the southeast corner of the asphalt paved lot surmounted with the monument. He's quoting these people's book. He says, Marek Bem does not even hesitate to write that, in all likelihood, the obelisk symbolizing the gas chamber and the monument of a woman prisoner with a child in her arms stand on the site of the gas chamber. But how likely is it, in fact, that any remains or traces corresponding to the alleged gas chamber building are actually to be found in the area pinpointed by Bem and Mazurek? As we have already pointed out in Sobibor, any remains of the alleged gas chambers must primarily derive from the second phase building, the outline of which must be estimated at a minimum of 10 meters by 13 meters. In this illustration, he has he showed that there's two squares across from on either side of this Himmelstrasse that they've hypothetical, and that must be, according to him, where the gas chamber is. And he shows this map of it. I don't want to read all these. He gives all the description and so on, and the, you know, the size and so on. moving down, here's the diagrams. This was the part I was going to skip. Despite this, none of Kola's basic drillings from they're back to Kola's drillings back in the early days. So I'm going to pass that too, because he's still talking about this, you know, pretty technical stuff. All right, this looks interesting. On 21st August 2012, an interview with Yoram Haimi and others appeared in online media. Yoram Haimi is that Israeli supposed archaeologist, but he's not really an archaeologist. But they had this interview conducted by the Associated Press, August 2012. In this, we read of the landmark excavation by Haimi and others, which included preparing a layout of the camp and pinpointing the location of the gas chambers, in quotes, where some 250,000 exclamation mark by Q's, Jewish victims are believed to have been murdered. In fact, the heavy concentration of ashes, he writes, is said to have led Haimi to estimate that far more than 250,000 Jews were killed. Even notorious Holocaust theologian Deborah Lipstadt chimes in, stating that any archaeological findings indicating a higher death toll are not out of sync with other research that has been done. Of course, they don't. No number is too high for these people. Oh, it fits right in with our other research. Haimi, that's spelled H-A-I-M-I, who, we learn, spends his ordinary working days carrying out digs for Israel's Antiquities Authority, dwells on the find of an identification tag. This is what I was thinking about earlier. Engraved with the name of a six-year-old Dutch Jewish girl, Leah Judith de la Pena, confirmed, so supposedly, by Yad Vashem as having been murdered at Sobibor, calling her the symbol of Sobibor and an example of indiscriminate mass murder. We also learned that at the time of the publication of the article, this Jaime was about to travel to Poland for yet another excavation session. The Israeli archaeologists at Sobibor, we further learn, are not allowed to bring any of their findings out of Poland, but Jaime is said to regularly consult the Yad Vashem's International Institute for Holocaust Research, which supposedly assists him in interpreting the findings and, quote, gives them historical perspective. So, you know, he's working with Yad Vashem or for them, and he, you know, goes and finds this and that, and then they put the meaning on it. They decide if it's important or not, and they give it historical perspective. That's because he doesn't know anything about that. As for the fabled gas chambers, Jaime's mapping of the Himmelfahrtstrasse is described as a, quote, major breakthrough, unquote, that has enabled him to determine, as Marek Bem puts it, where to look for the gas chambers. See how they play up, basically, this is playing up stuff in the news media that, oh, they're finding all the stuff there. Oh, it's really, you know, there's really stuff there. There's really bodies. They're really going to find it. And they keep this on people if they even read it. I don't know, but they, you know, if they're aware of it, it gives the idea that positive things are happening there rather than that nothing positive has happened for these people at all there. The article recounted above is a showcase, Hughes writes, of Shoah pseudoscience at its most pathetic and laughable. To begin with, there exists no, quote, other research, unquote, outside of the 70-year-old propaganda campaign pointing to a higher death toll at Sobibor, one exceeding 250,000, as brazenly claimed by Deborah Lipstadt. The same, of course, goes for Bem's absurd figure of over 300,000 victims. As shown by the Hufle document and other reliable data, and as acknowledged by Jules Shelvis, the number of Jews deported to Sobibor could at the most have been around 170,000. To maintain their assertion that almost twice that number were actually killed there, Lipstadt would have to either question the reliability of the Hufle document, which they would not want to do, and by extension, the Korher report, which repeats the annual total given by the former document, or to suppose that in 1943, Jews were not sent to Sobibor from previously unknown locations. Were sent, I'm sorry, I put a not in there. To suppose that in 1943, Jews were sent to Sobibor from previously unknown locations. You just have to add some more Jews going there. As the transports from Western, Central, and Southeast Europe, as well as those from within the general government, are fairly well known, there is very little margin to sift new victims from. The only real viable option seems to be the occupied Eastern territories, as seems to be hinted at by Bem from his out-of-the-blue mention of transports from Smolensk, Mogilev, and Bobruisk, but these would in turn threaten to compromise the Orthodox historiography on the Einsatzgruppen activities in the same region. The theologian Lipstadt should clearly refrain from counting other things than angels dancing on a pinhead. Let's see where I am here. I want to get to his ending. He's talking about Dan Mickman. Boy, that's good. I'd like to read that. But okay, I don't... this is not the one that I recall, but I'm going to have to use this. He talks about Mickman and just what liars these people are and just how they exaggerate and how they create a lot of humbug. And then he says, Jaime's use of Lea Judith de la Pena as the symbol of Sobibor, like another, you know, what's that girl? Oh, no, I can't think of her name. Dutch girl. Is nothing more than contemptible propagandistic appeal to emotions. The Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial's confirmation that she was murdered at Sobibor is, of course, completely vapid, as their database merely consists of transport lists coupled by forms filled in by Jews claiming the death of relatives, usually on the basis of hearsay or assumption. What can be verified is that Leah Judith de la Pena was reported to Sobibor. Deported to Sobibor. That's it. The fact that an identification tag bearing her name ended up buried in the soil in the camp site does not in any way prove she was killed there or anywhere else, or that Sobibor functioned as a pure extermination center. We are indeed fully in our right to ask, in the face of this disgusting propaganda, whether Jaime and others, his associates, would feel relieved if they learned that this little girl was not murdered in the camp, or if they would feel something akin to disappointment. That's that same argument. And they says that, as we have seen, all exterminationist attempts at resorting to hard scientific methods, including archaeological forensic surveys, have resulted in embarrassing failures. It is thus with great delight that we learn that Jaime have now set out to destroy the last refuge of the Sobibor gas chamber legend. We very much look forward to reports in their future findings. Well, they're saying that when they go and look for this stuff and they don't find anything, well, they're doing the revisionist work for them. They're happy to let them do that because they're sure that they won't find anything. And he uses the word that later on that they're putting the last nail in the coffin of the Action Reinhardt camp. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I've run out of time. Have a good evening. This is Carolyn Yeager at The Heritage.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyeager.com.